Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Bradley Davis, who is best known for a 25-year-old book entitled Mastering Joker Wild Video Poker. Tonight, Bradley's here to discuss a recent gambling encounter he had with the IRS that has applications for many of our listeners. The first thing I want to mention tonight has nothing to do with gambling. Longtime basketball player and basketball announcer Hot Rod Hundley died this past week, and I want to briefly remember him. My personal favorite recollection of Hot Rod came back in 1960 when he was a shooting guard for the Los Angeles Lakers, averaging about 12 points a game. I was a 13-year-old schoolboy living in Greater Los Angeles. On November 15th of that year, Elgin Baylor went off for 71 points, which was the all-time record up to that point. On the big night, the journalists all went around to the other players in the locker room to ask them what they thought of Elgin's 71 points. I know this because I read the sports page every day before I went to school. Now, when they got to Hot Rod Hundley and asked him about the 71 points, he gave a reply which I remember 55 years later. He said, "Me and Elge had great nights. Together, we scored 73 points." I've always loved a clever response, and that was a good one. Rest in peace, Hot Rod Hundley.
He was before I was interested in basketball, so yeah, didn't know who he was.
It's a great story, though.
Yeah.
Harry Reid from Nevada, currently minority leader in the United States Senate, has announced his retirement. Our show is not about politics, except when a political issue affects gambling. Harry Reid is currently the strongest pro-gambling voice on Capitol Hill. Whoever his replacement is, Democrat or Republican, they will be at the bottom of the pecking order in the Senate and have relatively little clout. Various anti-gambling forces will now have an easier time succeeding than when Reid was around. Our listeners generally benefit from the expansion of casinos because that offers us more opportunities to succeed. Whatever you think of the rest of Reid's slightly left-of-center politics, as gamblers, we will miss him. Richard?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think you said it all. I mean, okay. The rest of him aside, he was good for gambling.
One other subject. Gambling with an Edge is changing radio stations. Not intentionally, but our parent station is switching to an all-sports format. We could have stayed, but our show would be subject to being preempted during games and sometimes canceled at the last minute. Our last show under the current arrangement will be Thursday, April 16th. The following week, we will switch to internet radio. Beginning Tuesday, April 21st from 10 to 11 Pacific time, and that's in the morning. I'm sure you can listen to this live over the internet, but right now I don't know how to do that. But
it's VegasAllNetRadio.com.
VegasAllNetRadio.com.
But very, very few of our listeners listen live over the internet. The vast majority get it as a podcast, and so you will still be able to get it from all the same places that you got it before, and actually it'll come out 2 days early.
Yeah, 36 hours earlier or something. Depending on when Richard gets home and does this, he may not go directly home after the show, nor is he required to. We got an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com from a player in somewhere in Eastern Europe. And he was talking about this game that was something like Keno. Richard, what do you remember of this?
So he discovered this game that's sort of like Keno or Bingo, where they had made an error, and a certain way to bet this game actually had an edge for the player. The edge was about 1.8%, but he calculated that you would need to make $60 an hour, you would need a $750,000 bankroll. The variance was 150 on the game, and he just, he was happy that he found this edge, but he didn't know quite what to do with it. And there was a problem. You couldn't just bet like thousands and thousands of combinations because the game came every minute or two, and you had to fill them out, the cards out by hand. So I just said that it's great that you're looking at things that many people don't look at to find edges. You know, that I think is what we do as professional gamblers. You try not to limit yourself to one thing. So it's great that you're looking into these other things. You found an edge. But sometimes, even though you find an edge, it doesn't make it worth playing. If you have a $750,000 bankroll, you probably have far better uses for it than this Keno game that I think he said would yield $60 an hour or something, something small. So, even just because it's an edge doesn't mean it's worth playing. So,
interesting. I have a bankroll. Sometimes my opportunities aren't that big. Maybe I should move to Eastern Europe.
Right.
Okay. Let's talk to our guest. Bradley Davis was on our show a couple years ago talking about his book, Mastering Joker Wild Video Poker. He now lives in Colorado, and tonight he's going to be talking to us about something with the Internal Revenue Service. Bradley Davis, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, gentlemen. Always a pleasure.
Bradley, why don't you take about 10 minutes or so and tell us what happened regarding your 2009 tax return when it got audited. Auditing is something that's as much fun as root canals. Afterwards, Richard and I will ask you some questions about it.
All right. Sounds good. But before I begin, I need to make a public service announcement.
Uh-huh.
And I did talk to a tax professional, a gambling tax professional, just prior to coming on this evening, and this person really knows what they're talking about, and she was pretty negative on the whole idea, because she, when I described my circumstances, what happened, her take on it was I was lucky. And other people might get into trouble if they do the same thing that I do, or that I did, rather. So I'm not to blame if you do what I did and you're not successful. But if you are, then I'll certainly take all the credit for it.
Oh, good. And we can just send you $1,000 or so if it works
exactly.
For us. Does that work?
That'll work. That'll work just fine.
All right.
So what I'm going to be talking about, and I've been practicing this, and I'm pretty sure I can get it in 10 minutes, is my battle, and that's the right word, my battle with the IRS from June 2011 all the way till April 2012 that had to do with my 2009 tax return, where I filed as a part-time professional gambler, and they did not like that. And it went back and forth, quite a bit of correspondence, but in the end, I reigned victorious. I also have the advantage now that I believe that I have a gold-plated get-out-of-jail-free card, because I have a decision from the U.S. tax court saying that I don't owe them any money based on the way I filled out my taxes in 2009. And I also have the name of the appeals officer and his phone number that he said I could use if the IRS ever comes back to me again for the same issue and says, oh, no, you can't do what you're doing. So
that sounds like a pretty good thing to have.
There could be rewards.
Yeah, you better not let that guy retire. This is forbidden.
That is for sure. He did say, though, in my talks with him, that 100% of the time when he makes a decision on something, the IRS goes along with it. He's in the IRS, but he's sort of peripheral to the IRS, too. He's sort of the guy that tries to settle things out of court. His official title is appeals officer. All right, so having said that, let me get to my story. And by the way, if you need to interrupt me at any time, that's just fine. I'm going to be talking kind of fast to get through it all. But
well, good. This appeals officer, if somebody else has a problem with the IRS, should they go and ask for this particular guy?
You know, I thought you were going to ask me that question. And just in case he didn't do it exactly right, I don't want to get him in trouble either. So I don't know. I'm going to say no right now.
All right. But I have your email address. I might call you.
Okay, so you might, yeah. All right. So let me begin. A little bit of background first. I filed my first Schedule C as a part-time professional gambler in 1995. And the reason I did that, I think, is because I was already filing a Schedule C for my book business, publishing my own book. And it just seemed natural I should do it for my gambling activities, too. Prior to that time, I think what I was doing is just putting my winnings minus my losses as profit on page one of the 1040 under miscellaneous income, which was wrong, but I didn't know any better then. But then starting 1995, I started putting it on Schedule C, even though I was working full-time. Everything was fine for a while until 2002. I got my first notice of discrepancy letter. That's a form CP-2000 for auditing my year 2000 taxes. And let me say right now that I think what triggered that and has triggered the two subsequent audits I've had is the fact that the total amount of the 1099s and W-2Gs was in excess of the amount of money that I had put on line one of Schedule C under my business expenses. I believe the same thing would happen if under miscellaneous income on page one of the 1040, the number you have there is less than the total of your W-2Gs and 1099s. The IRS computer will automatically kick out your return if that happens. So a bit of advice to all your listeners, you don't want to do that.
Wait a minute. Isn't that true for every professional? I mean, you're saying that your net is less than the sum of your W-2Gs, right?
That's right, and that will trigger an audit.
Well, but everybody's net is less than the sum of their W-2Gs.
Well,
I mean, my W-2Gs, I do file as a professional, but my W-2Gs last year were $6 million and something, and my net profit was in the low six figures, which is considerably less than $3.5 million.
Well, how about this? Maybe it kicks it out, and then somebody looks at it, and then they decide if they want to pursue it further. But a safe way to do it, and I've been telling my tax man to do this now too, is make sure that number is in excess of the W-2Gs and 1099s, and then you can take off losses and the difference so that you end up with the right number, you know, at the end. But the first initial number, I think, better be higher than the W-2Gs and 1099s. You
okay.
May talk to your own tax person about that, but, you know, that's my opinion.
Okay.
All right. Well, moving on. What they said, and I talked about this, Bob, last time I was on your show, they wrote me a letter and said, you know what, you owe us taxes on $6,000 of gambling income. And I wrote them back and said, no, you're mistaken. If you look at my Schedule C, I don't owe you $6,000, I owe you $9,000, and I paid you that, and it's 15% self-employment tax. And then they wrote back and said, oh, you know what, everything is just fine. You don't owe us any money at all. And I had filed as a part-time professional gambler. And the way that I had filed, I actually paid more taxes that year than if I had filed, quote, the right way. So, moving along.
That sounds pretty dumb to me, but go ahead.
By the right way, you mean not putting on the Schedule C and just calling it miscellaneous income.
That's right. And you know what? My adjusted gross income wouldn't have got that much higher that year. I would not have had to pay 15% self-employment tax. I probably would have paid less tax. But
yeah. So why did you do this? This must have been some kind of long-term plan.
Well, yeah, because I considered what I was doing a business. And I wanted to get that status as a business, and I wanted to be able to take off expenses. Now, since I live in Denver and I have to drive up to Black Hawk and Central City, that's an hour's drive, I do have substantial automobile expenses. And the IRS is very generous in the amount that I can take off per mile. It's over 50 cents a mile. So I wanted it set up as a business, and I wanted to keep it as a business all these years. The only problem was I had a full-time job, too. All right, so time goes on, and nothing happens for many years, and then all of a sudden, 2011, I got my second notice of discrepancy for my 2009 taxes. Well, this one was a little bit more intense. On that particular year, it was pretty much a break-even year. I had about $3,000 in gambling wins, but I exceeded that in expenses, and I filed for no profit, no loss, a net zero on my Schedule C. They came back and said, oh, that's not exactly right. You owe us over $9,000 in taxes, over $1,900 in penalties, over $500 in interest payments, for a total of almost $12,000. And this is on a year when I had basically zero net income for gambling. And the reason they cited, and I'll just simply read it, it says, gambling winnings and any related expenses / gambling losses can only be reported on Schedule C, profit and loss for business, when gambling activity is pursued full-time for the production of income for livelihood. Well, I wasn't too upset because I knew, you know, just back in on my 2000 taxes, that's exactly the same way I had filed and there was no problem. So I explained this all in a letter to the IRS. And I also added the fact that, you know, if you want to look at it, this really is a business. And I sent them my detailed Excel spreadsheets of every casino I played and every number on the machine, the exact times of the minute and so forth, and I figured that's the end of it. That was in July of 2011. The rest of July went by, all of August went by, never heard anything from the IRS, and then all of a sudden, September 6th, I get a letter. And they said, we are unable to determine your, quote, professional gambling, unquote, status in this department. Therefore, we're not going to change anything, and you're going to get another letter of discrepancy. And sure enough, a week later, I got another letter. And this letter said, if you don't like it, your only option now is go to tax court. Well, my tax accountant at the time pretty much was going to throw in the towel at this time. He says, look, I can do an amended return. I'll put all your income on page one, the 1040, take off losses on Schedule A. You know, you'll have a high adjusted gross income, which is negative for a number of reasons. And then I thought, well, I'll still have all the interest and penalties, too. And I thought, that's just not fair. You know, the duplicity of the IRS to accept the way I was doing it as a part-time professional, where they got more money back, and then not to accept it later, you know, just really grated on me. So I waited and waited. I had 90 days, and I couldn't decide what to do. I was busy at work. And finally, just before the deadline on December 6th, I did file a petition to the tax court. And among the reasons I said that I was doing this is because I had contacted the tax advocate service, and this gal that took my case did research, and she found no IRS statute that said you can't be a part-time professional gambler. And I also looked on the internet, and I found a precedent, not a precedent, a summary opinion of somebody else that also took the IRS to task because he was doing it part-time, and he had a summary opinion in his favor. Well, after I filed with the tax court, I got a response from a tax attorney in Denver, and that's where the tax court was located, because he was obligated to respond to my allegations. And he just flat out denied everything that I had stated as the reasons for this legitimate petition against the IRS. And when it got to the point of there was no statute that said you couldn't be a part-time gambler, he actually admitted it. But at the very end, and I have the document in front of me, his conclusion was, wherefore it is prayed that the relief sought in the petition be denied, and that the respondent's determination as set forth in the notice of deficiency be in all respects approved. In other words, I continue to owe them $12,000. Well, at this point, I was angry. I was ready to go to tax court, plead my case to the judge, because I didn't want to get bullied by the IRS. I felt like Superman. I had truth, justice, and the American way on my side, and I was gonna battle these guys. I had never cheated on my taxes. I didn't feel I did anything wrong, and I was ready to go. A month later, I got a letter from the appeals officer, and he asked for quite a bit of documentation to prove to him that I had a legitimate professional gambling business. And let me just read that part of the letter that he sent. It says, the issues in your case are if you were in a trader business of gambling during 2009. If you were in a trader business of gambling, your losses would be deductible from gross income on Schedule C. However, if you were not in the trade or business of gambling, your losses would be deductible as an itemized deduction on Schedule A. Nowhere in there did it say anything about part-time versus full-time. So I sent a letter back to him. I'm almost finished, guys. Stipulating that there be three reasons that I... three stipulations for me to drop my case against the IRS. One is that they'd accept my 2009 tax return exactly as stated, that I didn't owe them any money, that they put a note in my file that if this ever comes up again, that they don't pester me anymore with these letters of discrepancy. And then number three, and I just threw this in, I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. I said, why on earth can't I deduct losses in excesses of winnings? If I was selling Tupperware, I'd be able to do that. Why can't I do that with a gambling business? Ultimately, I got one out of the three. I did have the IRS drop all charges against me. The appeals officer wrote a joint letter to me and the IRS. And let me just summarize what he said. He said, the IRS removed gambling losses from Schedule C and put them on Schedule A because they say petitioner is not a professional gambler. Is the petitioner a professional gambler? Yes. Petitioner has provided ample information to show that he is a professional gambler and running this activity in a business-like manner. Then he went through every one of the 14 stipulations of the new documents that he wanted, and at the end of it all, he said, petitioner has shown he's a professional gambler. I recommend that the government concede this issue. A couple weeks later, I got an official document from the U.S. Tax Court saying that there's no deficiency in my 2009 taxes, and I owe no money to the IRS.
All right. First of all, congratulations. It's always nice to win. I was surprised. I mean, when I talked to a police officer who was, it's basically yes, sir, except when they cross the line. Your letter back to them saying, I'm only going to do it if you do A, B, C, and D, I thought was an attitude that was going to get you in trouble. But
well, I had the attitude at the time.
I'm clear. And you got,
I have to say, first of all, I'm really happy you won this case. And I think you know, will help a lot of people. But, I would never deal with the IRS at all. I mean, I would have my tax person do it. So, yeah, I wouldn't have been writing any letters. But I was just talking to a friend last night who had an audit. He's a professional gambler, where basically the IRS agent just said, look, we're the IRS. And, you know, one way or another, we're going to get your money. You know, I mean, he really just threatened him. Would have been nice to have had a tape recorder in that meeting. But so I'm happy you got through this.
Now, were there... What were the three or four most important things that they looked at to prove that you were a part-time professional?
Okay.
We don't want to go through 19 of them, but...
I understand. And I have them written down here. Let me find that piece of paper. All right, the first one is kind of obvious. And you'll see this in any book that has anything to do with any business, and that is you have to have good records. And you have to start those records throughout the year. What you don't do is wait till the end of the year, and then you quickly try to figure out what all your monthly winnings are for, you know, every month of the year, and then make up a ledger and all that. They can kind of see through stuff like that. What I do, I have a form that I use when I go to the casinos, and I handwrite on the form. You know, I have check boxes for which casino I'm going to, what a game I'm playing, the machine number, and all that. As soon as I get home, I put that on a big Excel spreadsheet that keeps a tally, a continuous tally of my wins and losses month by month. And it comes up with a very comprehensive ledger of all my activities throughout the year in very precise detail down to the minute. That's one of the things that I sent the appeals officer that he was impressed by. It certainly was showing the business in the business-like manner. I have a few other things, but let me just say in general, too, if you want to be considered a professional gambler and have a professional gambling business, one should ask themselves the question, what would I be doing differently if I was an entrepreneur of my own company, and what sort of things would I be doing that I'm not doing now as a professional gambler? And then try to minimize the number of differences between those two. For example, one of the questions he asked me is, well, where's my business license? How many professional gamblers have business licenses? Well, it turns out I did, because I needed that license to sell my books. I have a local license and a state license. You need to show a very long, profitable, winning history. I would not recommend to any of your listeners that they start doing gambling this year and they're putting it in part-time and then they file a Schedule C next year as a professional gambler. I would say go ahead and do it the way the IRS wants you to do it on Schedule A and miscellaneous income until you have years of profitability. And then you can start thinking about putting it down as professional gambler, because you have to meet the 2 out of 5 rule. You have to have at least 2 years of profitability out of 5.
You know, I've had discussions with friends. I mean, I'm not convinced that it's better to file as a professional anyway, because you do get hit with that, whatever, 17% self-employment 15%. Tax.
Yeah.
So you'd have to have an awful lot of expenses to make up for what you're going to get hit with in the self-employment tax.
Well, there's another advantage. You can now take expenses off in excess of the losses that you have gambling. In fact, the appeals officer told me that too. And that's a fairly recent decision. Like, let's say you have a net year where your losses and your profits balance, but you have another, let's say, $5,000 or $10,000 in expenses. You can take that off Schedule C as a professional gambler.
You mean have a net loss?
No, it's not a loss. Expenses are not considered gambling losses. It's a different category.
But how do you write them off if you have no income? How do you write them off? What do you write them off against?
Well, your Schedule C. You show a net loss in the Schedule C. You take gambling losses off of profits. Let's say you have more gambling losses than profits. Well, you can't write off more losses than your profits. But after that, then you can take expenses off in addition to that, and you can end up with a negative number on your Schedule C, and that's legitimate.
Right, but you can't do that for more than 3 out of 5 years. You have to have profit 2 out of 5 years.
Yeah, but isn't it nice to know that if you have a year like that where you're not making any money, at the very least you can take off expenses?
Yeah, but on the years when you have profits, you're paying 17% off the top. That the person just putting it on the other schedule is not paying.
Yeah, but you also run the risk of a very high adjusted gross income, which could trigger the alternate minimum tax. So there's a lot of different types of write-offs that you can't take, educational write-offs. If you have kids in college, you know, that's a big deal. Gene Scott's and
Marissa Chin's
book, they have like a dozen different negative things that happen if you have a very high adjusted gross income. You can avoid that whole issue if you file a Schedule C instead.
Hmm. So if it's somebody's first year as filing as a professional gambler, the very first year, and let's say they do have a big profit, you still think it would be difficult to file a Schedule C?
What do you mean by the word difficult? I mean, anybody can do anything. I mean, difficult in terms of being acceptable by the IRS?
Yeah, being acceptable if you've never filed as a professional gambler before.
Yeah, I think, well, if you're – the big difference now is part-time versus full-time. If that's your only source of income or your primary source of income – I think you'll be okay. If you're doing it part-time, then you're apt to go through the same agony that I went through with the IRS, where they first deny it, and maybe you can get a sympathetic appeals officer to rule in your favor. But if you're able to do that, then you've got some clout on subsequent years if the same issue comes up, where you can say, hey, look, this already happened in years such and such. Here's the ruling from the tax court. Here's the letter from the appeals officer. I don't owe you anything.
Richard mentioned it earlier. Did you consider getting legal advice before you started writing these letters?
Other than just talking to my tax man, is that what you're saying, like a lawyer legal advice?
Yeah, I would think...
Yeah, exactly, like a tax lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess it's my own ego, Bob. I thought I could handle this myself. I did watch a video of somebody going into tax court, and it didn't seem that bad. You know, there was a judge there. There was someone representing the IRS, and then there was the plaintiff, and he simply presented his case to the judge, and the judge made a ruling. It didn't seem that bad, and I was ready to take on these bullies. You know, I didn't feel I had done anything wrong. I didn't find anything on the internet that said anything about.
But that often doesn't help in the American justice system. I mean, do you have a background in accounting or anything? Or?
No, I'm an electrical engineer.
Wow.
Okay.
So maybe I was naive, but. You know, I was up for the challenge. You know, I was angry, and I just wanted to see what I could do.
Yeah, anger is not always your friend when you're negotiating.
Well, like my tax guy said, you know, be careful not to poke the bear. So I toned down letters considerably from my first drafts and my correspondence with the IRS. So I'm getting better.
All right, good. So let's change subjects a little bit. 25 years ago, you wrote the seminal book on Joker Poker.
Okay.
Do you intend to always be a one-hit wonder, or is there another book in the works?
Well, you know, when I was first researching machines, I was going to write a book called Mastering Wildcard Video Poker, and it was going to combine Joker Poker and Deuces Wild. In retrospect, maybe I should have done that, but I started accumulating so much information just on Joker Poker that I said, you know what, I can do a whole book just on Joker Poker. I found 19 different varieties of the game, and it was so difficult classifying the hands and knowing how to do the strategies correctly. I said, you know, I think I can fill up a whole book just with that. So is there another book in the works? Probably not.
No, like many of us, you found that writing books pays like a dollar an hour. So
you get that much?
I wish it was that much.
Right.
Well, we talked to Frank Nealon about this last time too. It's a motivation thing. What was my motivation in writing the book? I wanted to contribute something, and I wanted to see if I could succeed in some other area other than my chosen profession. I wanted to see if I could write a book and people would buy it. And, you know, I think I succeeded in that. In fact, my fantasy now is that maybe someday people will recognize some of the pioneer work I did in this area and maybe get an honorable mention in the Video Poker Hall of Fame. That's my fantasy. Some of the things I did, nobody else had done. Nobody had four-color strategy cards. Nobody had short-term statistics in the book. There's a variety of different things in the book that no one else had done at the time.
So I have a question for you. I didn't know that you lived in Colorado, and I have a very good friend who lives in Colorado. Is there video poker out there worth playing?
If there's NSU deuces.
That's 99.7, if for those of you who that's not
right. Yeah, I mean my question isn't about the game so much as what do they send you in the mail.
All right, well, it's going away. More and more casinos now, when they have point multiplier promotions, they'll exclude video poker, sometimes entirely. You know, that it'll be 5 times points on slots, excluding video poker.
Wow.
It's becoming harder and harder to find good, high-denomination video poker machines. There's too many people like me out here. You know, there's too many people that are too knowledgeable, and they're making too much money or lowering the profits too much of video poker that the casinos are cutting back. So it's getting tough.
Well, until recently, there was a $5 maximum bet in Colorado. Has that gone away?
Yes, that went away a couple of years ago. It was an initiative on one of the ballots, on one of the November ballots, and it's up to $100 now.
And so, do
that's
they
helped a lot?
Do they get $20 video poker? So 5 coins times $20 equals $100, or
do well, they have I play $50.
So $10 single line.
No. Well, yes, they have that. Well, let's see. They have dollar 10 play. So what would that be?
That'd be $50.
That's $50. They also have 10-cent 100 play machines. And I think that's also $50 when you do the math.
Okay.
I was very fortunate in twice I've hit that machine for Delta Royal in the first line. So.
Well, that's a good player.
$40,000, yeah.
That takes extra skill.
Ah.
Oh, yeah, lots of extra skill to get it dealt to you. Unfortunately, after that happened, I was totally cut off from that casino, too. They stopped mailing me anything.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. That's not so unusual.
That's happened now, too, the casinos I play at, or used to play at, I should say. No letter or anything. They just, one day I walked in, I didn't get anything in the mail, and I said, what happened? And they said, well, you no longer, quote, qualify, unquote, for any mailback coupons. So that's life.
It's just astonishing how they run casinos. It really is mind-boggling.
Yes. Yeah, they don't understand the difference between being dealt and grinding it out. But
well, you know, I talked to the marketing manager, and I said, you know, I had a good year last year. I mean, why would you do that? And she said, well, look, it wasn't my decision. The corporate office in Reno makes all these decisions. And she said, and this astounded me, they've even cut people off for winning at slots. If you have a good year winning at slots, there's a good chance they'll cut you off for that, too.
Oh, yeah. That happened to a friend of mine here in town. They cut him off for winning at slots.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was he an advantage slot player?
He was not playing progressives or anything like that, no. I mean, he might have had an edge in other ways, but
he might have had an edge that we're not going to talk about, but okay, right. Good. Very good. All right. So I'm going to do some commercials now while Richard is casting his brain, figuring out more questions to ask you, Bradley. And we're talking to Bradley Davis about being successful at being ruled a part-time professional gambler. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more games than anybody else has. On Sunday, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, there's a $500,000 swipe, spin, and win promotion. That is, you play 300 points, go to a kiosk, and spin a virtual wheel. Prizes at the top end are $50 free play or $25 free play. The bottom end, you get 2,500 points. That's worth $7.50. You get a free breakfast buffet or a $10 restaurant credit. There are other prizes as well. This year, it's a random draw, meaning that whether your mailer is you get the top mailer or you just got a new card and have no history there at all, you have the same chance to get the top prize, which is $50 free play. Overall, this is a good deal. This is a successful low roller play if you live relatively nearby. There's a number of games there, including NSU and some others, where you can play the 300 points at a it's a positive game, and or at least a break-even game, and you get these additional bonuses. It's quite a bit. Getting $7.50, which is the bottom end for $300 a play, that's a 2.5% slot club. That's even Richard can play well enough to succeed with a 2.5% slot club. This coming Sunday, Easter, will be 2x points on video poker and 5x points on slots. All day, midnight to midnight, all machines, no limits. The next week's free video poker class at noon Wednesday in the Grandview Lounge will be what video poker players should know about slot clubs. Knowing and taking advantage of slot clubs is every bit as important as knowing the games and playing them well. Class is free, and everyone at least 21 years of age is welcome. At the Palms, they have a weekly 7 p.m. drawing on Fridays, where each week the winners share $10,000 with a top prize of $3,000. You don't need to be there to win. You need to claim the prize by midnight. 5x drawing entries Friday, 8 p.m. to midnight, and 2x entries on Friday between 4 and 6:30 in the afternoon. These drawings will continue through April 24th, after which they'll probably announce a new drawing. PFP, Play for Prizes, through April 10th will be Albertsons gift cards. Albertsons is a supermarket. And from April 13th through April 24th, the PFP prizes will be Lowe's gift cards. Lowe's is a home improvement, similar to Home Depot, I guess. Up to $190 per day, Monday through Friday, may be earned and may be redeemed. They redeemed at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your points. At videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. it's a good place to practice quick quads. For example, which I'll be playing next Sunday at South Point. And you can get the strategy from me or from the Wizard of Oz website. But if you want correction, go to videopoker.com and get the gold membership. The game of the week on the videopoker.com website is Dream Card Video Poker. Dream Card is a 10 coin per line game where periodically the fifth card is a dream card, which means the best card still remaining from the deck given the first four you've been dealt. Then you draw. You'll end up with more four of a kinds and royal flushes playing dream card than regular video poker, but it does take 10 coins per line, which keeps the game return in check. It has slightly positive EV compared to the game without the dream card. And there's no changes in the strategy. It's actually easier to play perfectly on the dream card than the regular game, simply because the dream card happens often enough that a lot of the penalty card situations disappear. Usually the card chooses the best dream card for you. In a few games like bonus poker, occasionally it doesn't. And in any case, you're welcome to change the dream card if you wish to. Okay, our guest next week is going to be Mohan Srivastava. Last time he was on, he said if I wanted to shorten, if that was too hard for me, I could call him George Srivastava. Okay, Richard, what do you remember about Mohan?
Well, we're going to talk about how to beat the lottery, scratch off tickets. But I wanted to... and actually, he was a very popular guest. We had a lot of emails about when we were going to have him back. So we are finally going to have him back and talk about that, talk about scratch-off lottery tickets. I wanted to ask Bradley if you thought the problem had more to do with the fact that you were listed as a professional gambler or the fact that it was part-time. What do you think about that?
I think it's the latter, that it's part-time. Because in the letter of discrepancy, they said you can only write it off if it's a full-time activity. So the inference is that they would not have said that if it was a full-time activity. Now, ironically, in the coming years, it will be a full-time activity, or at least... in my case, the majority of my income, because as of a month ago, I retired from my job of 40-plus years. So now that I have that status, it's like I don't need it. But yes, I believe that's right. It was the fact that it was part-time, not full-time.
And how many hours a year were you playing?
That's one of the questions that they ask me. And I have it written down here. It was significant, and if you want to succeed in making this a business, you have to show lots of hours doing this. I'm trying to find that paperwork.
In one of the emails you sent me, you said you spent more than 40 hours on a week at your regular job, and you averaged about 10 hours a week on your gambling, which would mean it's about 500 hours a year as a gambler.
You hit it almost right on the head. I have it right here, 530 hours of this activity in 2009. That's what I had reported. By the way, before we get off that subject, too, you asked for a couple of really important things.
Yes.
For your guest. I want to give them this IRS form number. It's entitled, Is Your Hobby a For-Profit Endeavor? And it's important that you follow their guidelines here. And they list about seven or eight things that would prove that this is more of a business than a hobby. It's form Frank Stephen, FS-2008-23. And that will steer people toward the types of things they need to do in order to prove that, that they have a business and this is not a hobby. Another thing that's important, too, is... have a separate checking account just for your gambling. Don't mix it in with your grocery money and that type of thing, but keep it separate, just like you would with a business. If you don't do that, then you might be considered this more of a hobby and not a professional business.
Well,
okay, I just wanted to get that in.
So what? Wait. So what? Are you saying that you would withdraw cash every week to go play video poker and then redeposit it in a bank account?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, what I really do, because you and I know that checking accounts earn no interest whatsoever to speak of, I have a lot of cash on hand.
Yeah.
So. No, I don't deposit it every week.
How much cash and where do you live?
it's not unusual, to have like $10,000 just lying around. Hopefully no one robs me, that type of thing, because I don't want to do that, because that can trigger problems too.
People get barred by their bank.
Well, yeah, they have to. Certainly any transaction over $10,000, they have to say something. But even cash transactions, especially deposits, of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, let's say every other week, that's a red flag to a lot of banks. I don't like to do that.
I'm serious. I know many people have had their bank accounts closed because of too many cash transactions. Especially Chase is notoriously bad for it.
I don't know how to get around that. It's kind of a cash business.
Right.
You can't say put it on my credit card if I win something. What do you do with that money? Well, it just sort of lays around for a while in my case, and then every now and then I'll make a big deposit. Hopefully more big deposits than big withdrawals.
Yes, that's the plan, and sometimes it works that way. Sometimes
one thing you can do is when you do hit, a Royal or something, you can ask them to pay you by check so that you deposit that in your bank instead of the cash.
And I've done that, and it looks a little better when you do that. I'll agree. Instead of coming in with wads of $100 bills, that looks bad. But a check is a better deal. Yes, that's a very good tip.
Very good. And we got almost 2 minutes. So, Rich, I have a question for you, a brief one. A player was playing at a casino, and the blackjack dealer was flipping cards unusually. Would that be an automatic red flag or what?
Yeah, so specifically, because I did see the email, anytime he had a six or less, he knew he was going to have to take a hit. So he would turn over his hit card and then use it to turn over his bottom card. He's just – some dealers like to come up with these fancy moves. I don't know. I just – I don't think it's anything to worry about. I think it's just a guy trying to show off,
Trying to show off or
– like some dealers, they like to turn over – if it's a handheld game, they like to turn over the hit card with one hand, kind of deal it off with their index finger of the hand that's holding the deck, as if that's a skill of some sort.
Well, it is a skill. I can't do it.
Yeah. But, dealing is boring. They have to come up with something to do. But anyway, it's not something I would worry about.
Okay. Very good.
I also just want to say we always want your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can find me on Twitter at RWM21. You can get the show delivered automatically, YouTube, iTunes. Just sign up. It'll come to you in your sleep.
Thank you, Bradley Davis. Good night. Hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.